Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chuck Collins, author and a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, who discusses the opportunities for progress on reversing income inequality, a major issue in this year's presidential election campaign. Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who examines the growing skepticism surrounding the impeachment of Brazil's president, Dilma Rousseff. And Claire Miller of the Toxics Action Center, who explains why a coalition of environmental groups are calling for a halt to the nation's conversion to natural gas and move instead to a true clean energy economy. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Australians were outraged over the image of a hooded 17-year-old Aboriginal detainee, Dylan Voller, strapped into a metal chair during the Australian Broadcasting Company's Four Corners TV program. The video of the juvenile prisoner brought back haunting memories of the torture of prisoners at the Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad, Iraq, and detainees held at the Guantanamo Bay prison camp in Cuba. Australia's Conservative Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull called for an inquiry into youth detention facilities in the Northern Territory, the location of the Don Dale Youth Detention Centre in Darwin, where Voller was held. In the province, nearly all youth detainees are Aboriginals. The use of a chair restraint is very controversial in Australia, but the local government has expanded its use. A 2015 report by the Territory's Children's Commissioner criticised the behaviour of guards at the Don Dale Detention Centre, where video of Voller and other Aboriginal boys was shot in 2014 and 2015. Amnesty International observed that the images of a hooded detainee recalls the horror of Guantanamo Bay and constitute a shocking violation of both the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child and the Convention Against Torture. America's opioid addiction epidemic became the focus of corporate media coverage during the early days of the 2016 presidential campaign. Now, President Obama has pledged $1 billion for treatment, and Republicans are discussing the damage done to lives from opioid abuse. Yet, with little attention and no opposition, legislation passed Congress and was signed into law by President Obama that will make it more difficult to take action against opioid manufacturers. The new law allows pharmaceutical companies who fail to report sales of these drugs to black marketeers to submit a corrective action plan, avoiding stiff penalties from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. The bill had the full backing of the U.S. pharmaceutical industry. According to the Los Angeles Times, the legislation and the clout of Big Pharma on Capitol Hill prompted Joseph Ranazzisi to resign his post as Deputy Assistant Administrator at the DEA last fall. The former DEA official observed, "There's thousands of people dying from opioid overdoses, and this bill is going to provide protection to people we are investigating." Nearly 200,000 people have died from overdoses of opioid drugs across the U.S. since 1999. In 2012, Barack Obama captured 73% of the Asian American vote to win re-election. The surge of support for the Democratic candidate was only exceeded by the enthusiasm of African American voters for Obama that year. Yet, 20 years earlier, Republican President H.W. Bush won a strong majority of the Asian American vote in what was then viewed as a culturally conservative community. Asians who began immigrating to the United States in the mid-1800s have a history of keeping their distance from electoral politics, especially after the World War II unconstitutional internment of Japanese Americans. Yet, many Asian American voters supported Republicans, including the first President Bush, during the post-Vietnam Cold War era. According to the American Prospect magazine, during the 1990s, President Bill Clinton reached out to the Asian American community, which began an historic shift that rivals the switch of political loyalties among African Americans from Republicans to Democrats during the New Deal era of the 1930s. The power of the Christian right inside the GOP and Donald Trump's angry anti-Muslim rhetoric has alienated many Asians from supporting the Republican Party. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
Thanks in part to the economic agenda of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders during his unsuccessful Democratic Party primary campaign and the Occupy Wall Street movement that emerged in 2011, the issue of income and wealth inequality has become a topic of serious debate in this year's presidential election campaign. Workers fighting for a rise in the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour across the U.S. have also highlighted growing frustration and anger about the growing gap between the nation's rich and poor. According to a new analysis by economist Emmanuel Saez, Americans in the bottom 99% of the country's income distribution saw their take-home pay rise 3.9% in 2015 over 2014's levels, adjusted for inflation, the highest increase in 17 years. But the top 1% wealthiest Americans' income grew by 7.7% last year, giving us the highest levels of income inequality in U.S. history. Your reporter spoke with Chuck Collins, an author and director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and an activist with the group Patriotic Millionaires. Here he discusses the opportunities for progressive change on the issue of income and wealth inequality in this year's presidential election campaign.
Well, I definitely agree that there's an awakening, that more and more people are drawing connections between their own economic circumstances and these larger economic trends. I think coming out of the economic meltdown, we sort of started to break the taboos around talking about class and inequality. And I think part of that is that, you know, we have a very high tolerance for inequality in the United States, as long as we feel the system is working for the rules are fair and that anybody can work hard and have the opportunity to get ahead. And I think what's happening is more people are realizing that the rules are rigged and that social mobility is declining, that people are working extremely hard, but they're stuck in first gear or they're slipping backwards. And I think that's people's real life experience. And then I think, you know, when you have somebody like Bernie Sanders get up and say, this isn't just your individual problem, this is a societal problem, it's a systemic problem, I think it lifts that issue up. But I even think Donald Trump's campaign is, in a way, speaking to the same problem, which is a growing number of people who feel like they are just slipping backwards, whether it's because of global trade or whatever explanation they have. It's the same symptoms, if you will.
Chuck, I wanted to ask you about the vehicles for change in terms of reversing inequality. Tax policy is huge. If you had the ear of a president or powerful politicians in Congress and could recommend changes to our tax code or tax policy overall, what would be the most important things that you would recommend?
I guess I would reverse some of the tax cuts for the wealthy that we've put in place over the last couple decades. So I would raise the top income tax rates on, you know, incomes over $1 million up. I would make the inheritance tax, or what we call the estate tax, more progressive, meaning estates over $1 billion, I would have to pay at a much higher rate than estates over $10 million, which is where it starts. I would put in place a financial transaction tax. It slows some of the speculative activity on Wall Street, but it also raises substantial money. If I could link some of those revenue raisers to things that actually would make a huge difference in people's lives. So I think a debt-free college education fund, certainly at public and state universities, could be easily funded by a financial transaction tax or a more robust tax on wealth and inheritances. Those are the kinds of things that we did after World War II. 1947 to 1977, we taxed the wealthy at higher rates, and we invested in things that helped broaden opportunity, home ownership, debt-free education, infrastructure investments that employed people. Those are the kind of things that I think we should do again.
Well, Chuck, what about tax avoidance? We have hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars going into offshore tax havens from wealthy folks here in the United States and all across the world. But when it comes to the United States, what could be done to prevent all these tax revenues that could support infrastructure and education and these other investment programs? What could be done to stem the flow of dollars outside the U.S. and the tax revenue that goes with it?
Well, you know, there are a couple of things. There's, as you mentioned, Scott, the offshore system that the Panama Papers and others have revealed. And then there's the huge kind of loophole industry, both that individuals and corporations use to reduce their taxes. Those are actually things that can be fixed if there's a political will. There are certain trust mechanisms that are just set up entirely for the purpose of tax dodging, and those could just be ruled illegal. Some of the international stuff would have to be done in concert with other countries. We would need treaties to expand transparency of both corporate tax reporting and individuals' ability to hide their wealth around the world. But the United States has huge power in that equation. If the United States took the lead, other countries would certainly follow. So it's really a question of political will. You and I and our listeners just need to say it's not okay that there's this huge sort of shadow tax system that allows global corporations and very wealthy people to sort of opt out of their responsibilities to paying taxes. But it's totally fixable.
If you were an advisor to some of these very passionate Bernie Sanders supporters who have a mind to continue their political activism in the coming year, hopefully after the election is over in November, what would you have them focus on in terms of economic inequality? What kind of political agitation do you feel would be useful and an efficient use of their time?
Well, I guess my encouragement would be to remember that it's not really about the candidates. It really is about all of us organizing, making our voices heard, maybe even running for office. I would encourage people not to be discouraged, to understand we put huge pressure on the political system and on the platform and have changed the conversation. And to keep that work going, basically have to keep doing it at all different levels.
That was Chuck Collins, director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. Collins, also an activist with the group Patriotic Millionaires, is the author of the forthcoming book, Born on Third Base. Learn more about the fight to reverse growing income inequality by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As Brazil prepares for the opening of the 2016 Summer Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro, U.S. corporate media has focused much of its attention on the threat posed by the mosquito-transmitted Zika virus and the health hazards athletes will be exposed to from untreated sewage flowing into waterways where sailing and swimming competitions will be held. But most Brazilians are focused on their nation's political crisis, where President Dilma Rousseff, who was suspended from office in May, will soon be put on trial in the Senate on charges of breaking budgetary rules. If convicted, she will be removed from office. While there's very little attention paid to Brazil's impeachment process in the U.S., 40 Democratic members of the U.S. House of Representatives published an open letter directed at U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry on July 25th, expressing their deep concern about threats to democracy in Brazil. The letter, which was written with support from the AFL-CIO, stated that the impeachment process has come under fire for procedural irregularities, corruption, and political motivations. The letter went on to urge the Obama administration to express concern about the threat to democratic institutions unfolding in Brazil, one of Washington's most important political and economic allies in Latin America. Underscoring the growing skepticism surrounding the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, a Brazilian federal prosecutor recently asserted that the charges of budget accounting maneuvers that triggered the impeachment process are not a crime or an impeachable offense. Your reporter spoke with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who examines the mounting criticism of Brazil's impeachment of President Rousseff.
Well, I think the most important recent development, which just happened last week, is the 43 members of Congress Democrats signed a letter to John Kerry saying that the United States should not support this impeachment process. Now, that's really big, you know, and it's interesting. This shows you the problem of the media in the United States. Only one news outlet, major news outlet, even sizable news outlet in the U.S., reported on it, and that was the Los Angeles Times. And I think that's because they have a particularly good reporter in Brazil, but nobody else touched it. Now, this is very rare. You know, we've seen a lot of letters on Honduras, for example, to the Secretary of State. But, you know, Brazil is a huge country, population of more than 200 million, and bigger landmass than continental United States. And you don't see Democrats, dozens of Democratic members of Congress, doing, I've never seen it actually, pushing back against their own Democratic administration and president on policy towards a country like Brazil. It's very rare. And I think one of the reasons it happened is because most people who are looking at this know that the U.S. kind of supports the impeachment. In fact, I wrote this today, but I can't reveal the source, but he was a member of Congress on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He said, yeah, it was very clear to him that the Obama administration is in favor of this coup. Now, who knows what they're doing to help it along? They officially have a position of neutrality, which is bad enough. But there is evidence that they did support the coup. I think I mentioned this before on this program, that a couple of days after the coup, one of the leaders of the coup in the Brazilian Senate, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Aloysio Nunes, came to the U.S. and met with the number three person in the U.S. State Department, Tom Shannon, who was also a former Brazilian ambassador and is certainly the one in charge of deciding what U.S. policy should be. So just by meeting with him right after the impeachment vote in Brazil, he was sending a signal, kind of a dog whistle diplomacy, to everyone in Brazil that they really did have the back of the people who are carrying out this coup.
And I've read that a federal prosecutor in Brazil says President Dilma Rousseff budget accounting maneuvers that triggered the impeachment process are not a crime and do not represent an abuse of power, which is one of the things that would have to have happened for the impeachment process to go forward. Now, from what I understand, the interim president, Temer, basically denies that this federal prosecutor has any legal power to derail the impeachment process.
Well, technically that's true. The Senate can do whatever it wants, just like here, the House of Representatives did impeach Bill Clinton, and the Senate could have voted to convict him no matter what the charges were and whether they were an impeachable offense or anything. So, yeah, they're saying we're going to go ahead anyway. But it could be a tight vote. We don't really know. They need a two-thirds majority of 81 senators, so they need 54. And the other side, to block the impeachment, would need 28. There is a group called the G36 there, of 36 senators who said they won't vote for the impeachment, but some of them made that conditional on Dilma agreeing to a referendum on whether to hold new presidential elections, and Dilma did agree to that. So if they can reach an agreement on a referendum, then she would stay. And if you can move, you know, just a couple of senators, actually, in that direction, she would stay. But a lot of people in Brazil, you know, a lot of experts think that that's pretty tough because it's so corrupt. The whole system and the Congress is so completely corrupt that they're just assuming that they will buy the votes that they need.
Yep. I've read that the MST, Brazil's landless workers movement, has threatened to shut down the country if Dilma Rousseff is not returned to power and, you know, this impeachment process is not upended. That could be a potential real flashpoint for the nation of Brazil as you get into these Olympic Games here.
Well, there is. That's right. There is a lot of resistance. There's millions of people who still support the Workers' Party and they're against the impeachment. And yeah, there will be protests, and there will be a lot of eyes on the country during the Olympics. So right now, Brazil is being ignored by most of the media, except for the Olympics. I mean, it is kind of amazing, too, when you think of the coverage that's given to political events in other South American countries. And here is Brazil, the biggest, most important of them. And they have a government that's questionable legitimacy for the first time since the military dictatorship, which, you know, isn't that long ago. You know, it ended just over 30 years ago.
That was Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, whose new book is titled Failed, What the Experts Got Wrong About the Global Economy. Find more analysis of Brazil's political crisis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A new report that evaluated several recent research papers shows definitively that natural gas is not a bridge to a clean energy future. The report was released by Toxics Action Center, the Frontier Group, Environment America, and more than a dozen community groups across New England at a press conference held in Bridgeport, Connecticut in late July. Bridgeport is the current site of Connecticut's last remaining coal-fired power plant, which is slated to be converted to use natural gas as an energy source. Bridgeport's coal plant that produces electricity for the region not only contributes to climate change, but also pollutes the air, with harmful effects on the health of the low-income, mostly Black and Latino community in its midst. The report titled Natural Gas and Global Warming shows that older claims that gas has a modest impact on the climate are wrong, as they fail to account for the greenhouse gas effect of methane and high rates of methane leaks from gas infrastructure. The Coalition of New England Environmental Groups are calling for a halt to the region's gas infrastructure build-out and a quick conversion to a true clean energy economy. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Claire Miller, lead community organizer with Toxics Action Center, who talks about the report and the energy future this coalition of environmental groups are working for.
We're seeing the older fleet of old coal-fired power plants, old nuclear power plants, phase out. And in that wake of opportunity, the gas industry is really hoping to bring on a whole new wave, a new generation of gas-fired power plants, pipelines, compressor stations, LNG tanks. You know, we're still kind of feeling the ripples of the fracking boom.
How has the energy situation changed over the past decade, and how do big fossil fuel plants fit into it?
That's the way that we're used to making electricity, is by big, large power plants. That's the way that we've run our grid since we electrified, you know, back in like the 20s and 30s. And the grid of the future is different. It's thousands of solar panels scattered across roofs and on top of landfills. It's offshore wind 30 miles out into federal waters. It's a fundamentally different vision. So, you know, there's this kind of like moment where we are either going to go down this road and build a whole other generation of fossil fuels that will set us way back, or we actually have to kind of take that leap and begin really building the grid of the future.
Claire Miller, a lot of gas projects that people are opposing, pipelines, power plants, and more, are well on their way to construction. So do you think it's too late to stop them?
That is a really interesting question. I feel hesitant to say that it's ever too late. I was chatting with one of the community leaders from Oxford earlier this month, and there's some scandal around the investors, you know, some of the financials around the plant out there. So who knows? It's got all of its permits, to my knowledge, but that definitely doesn't mean that it's a done deal. And the same can be said for Bridgeport. You know, a lot of things can happen. There's a lot of moving parts and policy happening in different parts of the region right now.
The evidence is mounting that so-called natural gas is not the bridge to the clean energy future.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I want to say 10 years ago, most of the environmental community also thought that gas was going to be the bridge fuel, that it was going to, ease our way into adopting a fundamentally different type of grid that's more decentralized, where people get their power from the solar panels in their neighborhood. And so it's not necessarily, I don't blame people for still kind of thinking in that paradigm, but the evidence, the report that we released, which was a review of all of the different studies that have looked into this, is that it's all awash when the fact is the gas leaks everywhere. When you're drilling it out of the ground, some of it leaks out. When you put it from the wellhead into the truck, some of it leaks out. When you put it from the truck into the pipe, some of it leaks out. It's just every step of the way, there's fugitive emissions, and it just, because methane is so much more potent than carbon, it's just a complete wash. And any of those benefits, as far as global warming mitigation, are just totally lost. So my recommendation to all of us in New England is to grapple with that as hard and as fast as we can. We already get nearly 50% of our electricity from gas, which is a lot of eggs to have in one basket. And we do not want to continue to be dependent on such a volatile fuel source where the prices are going up and down. It's too risky for our economy and for our climate. Let's go as fast as we can. The trends are really interesting. So in the year 2000, New England was getting 15% of its electricity from gas. And in the year 2015, we're getting 49%. For nuclear power, it's almost the same. We've gone from 31% to 30%. The things that are decreasing are coal and oil. From 2000 to 2015, coal went from 18% of the pie to 4% of the pie. That's great. And from 2000 to 2015, oil went from 22% to 2%. Also awesome. So we've seen this really great decrease in a fossil fuel, but the unfortunate thing is that it's ultimately been almost entirely replaced by another fossil fuel, which ultimately is not getting us any gains for global warming. It's definitely better for our air quality. I don't want to brush over that, but we also have this big elephant in the room called global warming.
That was Claire Miller, lead community organizer with New England's Toxics Action Center. For more information and a link to the group's energy report, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.